All right, good morning. This is the Board of Public Works. The day's date is May 18, 2011. We have a presentation, I believe, at some point early this morning on the revolving loan fund and how we maintain the dams in our state, such as they are. And so we're going to get to that in a second, but I'm wondering if the Comptroller or the Treasurer have any opening thoughts, comments.
Governor, Madam Treasurer, thank you. I do just want to make a couple of comments because I've been traveling around the state a lot visiting businesses that are creating jobs, and I've just seen some wonderful examples of the genius of the private sector in Maryland, and it makes me very proud of the entrepreneurial spirit we have and the fact that we are going to be entering into a recovery and jobs and prosperity are around the corner. I call for nominations for a Better for Less award, which I'm presenting to a business in each jurisdiction, to recognize Maryland businesses who have demonstrated entrepreneurship and innovation to deliver better results at reduced costs. And these are businesses that have been hammered by the recession, but have resiliently re-engineered their practices. So that instead of being threatened, they're actually surviving and, in these instances, thriving. I've visited 20 counties plus Baltimore City. I've got three to go to award recipients an award in person. The sound management principles and ingenuity that I've seen have inspired me. The talent and opportunity we have in Maryland is second to none. One award went to BJ's on the water in Ocean City. I hadn't had a chance to go there, Governor, but it's a wonderful restaurant. It's founded by a born and bred Marylander that's utilized creative marketing, outstanding customer service to keep pace in the toughest economy we've seen in generations. Just a couple of miles away from the Delaware line, where there are lots of competition, as you know, BJ's is thriving as a destination point for Marylanders and visitors to Maryland. On the other side of the state, in Hagerstown, there's Beachley Furniture. It's a 100-year-old family-owned furniture business. Owner is David. I think David is his first name, Beachley. Part of the worst economic recession we've seen in generations. Family-owned business completely changed direction and focus to move into the custom furniture business. He said, we made most of our profits over 100 years from the Beachley line of furniture. All of a sudden, we had to drop the entire line, come up with some other business model. Otherwise, we would have had to close our doors. They took a huge risk. Their new design catalog that they've created is flying off the shelf. Their expertise is in demand on a national basis. They've got a tremendous workforce that I met. And just as an example of a nimble response to tough times and it made me very proud, frankly, of the state that we live in. Some have embraced technology, like the furniture company I just mentioned. Some have made tough choices. Some have been creative about their market niche. I visited Rich Roofing in Baltimore City. An unbelievable company owned by an African-American woman entrepreneur who was, a nurse or something. But her husband had this roofing business. He passed away. She took it over. And, God bless her. A lot of employment. E-Structures in Howard County, company that didn't exist a few years ago. Now it's one of the nation's leading recyclers of computers and electronic equipment. Once again, adapting to what we have out there. Giving good customer service and taking advantage of strategic opportunities. So I just wanted to compliment the ingenuity and the best ideas that are flourishing out there in the private sector. And I really think Maryland is the envy of many states because of these small businesses that don't get a lot of recognition, but are out out there producing jobs for our friends and neighbors and Marylanders. Governor, thank you. For that, I'll be in Queen Anne's later on today presenting one of these awards, and a lot of good stuff going on out there.
That's absolutely true. I'll be at Amtech headquarters in Columbia today, part of
Great.
Our new economy and businesses expanding. I think 80% of our jobs are supported. Our jobs that are supported by small business. So, great comments, Madam Treasurer.
I'll be in the office working for you. I know many thousands of hardworking state employees.
Greg, well, let's get into the dam presentation.
Yes, sir. Mr. Governor, I'm sir, Comptroller, several.
The court reporter should note that's DAM.
Several weeks ago, the board asked DGS to get with MDE and talk about a presentation relative to a dam revolving fund. Mr. Jay Sakai from the Maryland Department of Environment is certainly the lead on that, and is here this morning to walk you through the presentation.
Good morning, Governor O'Malley, Comptroller Francho, and Treasurer Kopp. I want to thank the board for this opportunity to provide you a brief overview of our program and some maybe some suggestions on how we might address this problem. With respect to financing. With your indulgence, I'm going to go through a brief presentation just to give you a little background on the program itself, and then we'll talk a little bit about our recommendations. Maryland's had, the Department of Environment has a regulatory oversight over dam safety. We have a little over 400 dams in Maryland. These are regulated entities that have to comply with dam safety regulations, which means they have to be able to handle the maximum probable flood. And with this regulatory program, safety, public safety, is really the preeminent issue that we address. So typically what happens in the course of an inspection of a facility, we will often find structural problems with the facility that would potentially undermine the structural integrity of a dam. Often it's a spillway issue. Many people, when they think about dams in Maryland, they have in their mind the very large facilities. Lock Raven Dam is a good example of what people think about when they think of dams. The reality is we have, aside from the hundreds of regulated dams in Maryland, we also have thousands of small ponds that are also, in effect, dams. And many communities have grown up around these facilities over time. And then as time goes on, they require maintenance, capital investment, and often it is the homeowners that are left with the task of coming up with the money to repair. So often it is it's a spillway, it's a pipe that has to be repaired. None of this is ever inexpensive, and typical repairs for a small dam repair would range in the several hundreds of thousands.
There are very few natural lakes in Maryland, true?
That is true.
I mean, if any. So virtually any lake you see, whether has a dam somewhere, or it wouldn't be a lake. Right?
Yeah, that's correct, Governor. And if you think of many of the lakes that people enjoy recreation on, at the head of that lake is a dam that was put in typically decades ago. Most of the lakes, the small lakes that communities have grown up around, aren't in effect entrainments that are being supported by a dam downstream. Often the community will never know that there's a dam downstream. And many times when they find out that there is a dam safety problem and a repair issue, they're very much surprised that they have some responsibility for this repair. So we have faced this problem frequently, and historically there's been very little funding. Certainly not within any of the state programs for these types of repairs. And from the department's perspective, it's certainly the funding part of this is certainly something that I think is an important issue to address. With respect to funding options, we took, as tasked by the board, a very hard look at what potential options might exist out there for a private homeowners association that was faced with the task of a dam repair. And what we've come up with is, in terms of the Department of the Environment, we have several existing funding programs that have historically not been used for dam repairs. Yes, ma'am.
I might have missed this, but is there a numeric breakdown between the three categories?
I believe there is a report that we had submitted, and if not, I'll provide it forthwith with the breakdown. We have, just to go back, the categories of dams, we classify them according to public safety hazard. We have high hazard dams, we have significant hazard dams, and we have low hazard dams. It really depends on our assessment that if the dam, in fact, catastrophically failed, would there be potential loss of life and significant infrastructure damage. So we have a limited number of high hazard dams that we inspect more frequently and a lower number of low hazard dams. So there is a breakdown.
Jay, your report is in the record and it does have the numbers in it.
Thank you. So with respect to funding, we've looked at various options here, and internal to the department's own program, we do have a revolving loan program that we think can be brought to bear here as maybe one of the first options for addressing this. Historically, we have not used this Clean Water Revolving Loan Fund for dam safety repairs. Now, the change here is that there's been much in part because of a lot of the work that we've done with the Bay TMDL, a recognition that there's a pretty clear linkage between sediment entrainment behind dams and potential sediment loss and sediment impacts if the dam were to fail. So we can now make this connection between clean water, water quality, and dam repairs. Under the premise that the failure of a dam would result in a very significant release of sediment to the waterway. So, and this is something that we work out with the Environmental Protection Agency, which passes through the majority of our revolving loan fund money. So there is, and we are recommending that we take make greater use of the SRF, existing SRF program, to address dam safety problems. There's another option that is has not been used very much in the past, and I think it's more a question of it's not particularly well advertised. We have what's called a link deposit program. And the link deposit program is a Department of the Environment funding program that allows private entities who secure capital through their own funding sources to receive an interest rate reduction. In effect, the state subsidizes the interest rate component, and it lowers the interest rate and brings more affordability into this. We've had this program in place for some time, it's I think it's clear to everybody that we can do a better job of making dam owners that are subject to compliance problems more aware of the opportunity to take advantage of the link deposit program. And there is, as I said, a more detailed write-up about the structure of those two programs within the report that we had submitted. And then finally, one of the recommendations that the board had asked us to look at is the opportunity for creating or the value of creating a standalone revolving loan fund type program specific to dam repairs. And that's certainly an option, and there may be some benefits in doing that in that, if an applicant, a dam owner, comes in for under the current revolving loan fund for a loan, it's a competitive program and he's competing with a lot of other people for that money. A dedicated program would limit the universe of funding just to these dam owners. I will tell you that Historically, there have not been large numbers of outstanding compliance problems with dams. We currently have about a half a dozen existing compliance orders with these owners. But as these dams age over time, we fully expect this to be a growing problem in the future. And obviously, one of the things we're trying to do along the way with this program is increase public awareness of the shared responsibility that many people have if they happen to live on a lake that is supported by a small dam. So I'm going to leave it at that and be happy to answer any questions that you might have with respect to the basic recommendations.
I just want to thank you for this. I think it's excellent, and it came from, as you know, a couple of agendas ago. We had some small dam repair projects, and in looking at those, apparently there are dozens that are eligible or would like to follow, but there's no funding available. And the treasurer was talking about all the great employees we have in the state of Maryland. I've got one sitting right next to me here, Mr. Klassmeyer, who said, why don't we try to, in an innovative way, set up some kind of a revolving fund? So whether it's a revolving fund that the legislature creates or this link deposit, which I think is very interesting, that you mentioned, or the existing fund that you have, I really appreciate your attention to it. And if you, whatever you come up with, if you could name it after Mr. Klassmeyer, I'd be grateful. And I think it's, you know, a great testament to your agency, Governor, that, you know, they, tough times come up with something that perhaps will pay for itself.
Let's see, I saw a map in here in your slideshow. Is that live? Can any citizen go on that and click on where the dams are?
We do not have that live. The department is working through a revamp of its website, and there was some discussion about making more of this information available to the public, so that public, you know, people don't know they live on the dam; they can at least see it on the map. So we'll certainly take that back.
Good. I really want to see it live. The same way, Department of Transportation, the we should have the structure. Are the structurally deficient bridges online, or all of the bridges online, and then their ranking in terms of which ones are the most structurally deficient? That should be online, too. Can't expect people to make informed decisions about infrastructure investments if we keep hiding from them the reality of what's underneath there, you know, the wheels.
The high hazard ones, of which I recall there was something like 70, is that? Sheila?
Yes, sorry.
71.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
The high hazard dams are 71 high hazard dams, 100 significant hazard dams, and 232 low hazard dams. There are, in fact, 71 of the high.
So if you focused on the first two categories where they're probable, a possible loss of life, are those, is there any pattern of ownership? I mean, are they owned by large corporations, communities?
The majority of the high hazard dams are owned by government entities.
So this is both public and private?
This is public and private.
Okay.
And as you might expect, you know, certainly the largest, most hazardous facilities are owned by municipalities, their water supplies. The Department of, in fact, Natural Resources owns a number of them. Most of them are controlled by municipalities and government entities.
And those are the ones that are inspected by us every year?
Well, the high hazard dams are the ones that we inspect every year, and then we have a tiered inspection regime depending on the level of hazard and classification of the dam.
Okay, yeah. So the high you've got to have a matrix of both high hazard and likelihood of failure or condition. Right?
That's
you could have something in pristine condition. If it ever went, it would be a terrible thing.
Yes, ma'am. The classification of the dam has to do with the consequences of its failure, not its current condition. So the high hazard dams are not the ones that we have designated as impending failures. They're the ones that, if they fail, they may be in great condition. If they fail, they would result in a...
So is that matrix? I'm sorry, I don't have the big...
Yeah, no, I'm not looking, I'm looking to see if there are the ones that are actually in danger. I don't know that that information is in here.
And therefore, you inspect them more regularly.
That's correct. That's correct.
So you, among the high hazard ones... I trust the state is maintaining
them. I think that's an excellent question because it gets really to the heart of how we establish priorities in the program. If there's a dam in a high hazard classification, that through our inspection process we determine that there is a compliance problem, meaning that there is some dam safety issue. And an example would be the Savage River Dam was such a facility. It had problems with the gate structure. They had an inability to open and close the gates effectively, and they needed a repair. It was, in this case, a very significant multi-million-dollar repair that took place. What we do on the compliance side is, for that classification of dam, is to compel compliance immediately, which means that the dam owner has really two options that they have to undertake. They have to reduce the hazard, and they can do that by reducing, draining the lake, in effect. In many cases, we require them to lower the lake level to a safe level, and then it buys them time to undertake the repair. If they choose not to do that, we have a variety of different enforcement tools. We have had to go to compliance orders to compel high hazard dams to be repaired more quickly. And always this is driven by concerns about public safety. So if we have a dam that's an imminent failure, that's a high hazard, we would compel repair very quickly. It is also within the department's authority, should the dam owner not choose to cooperate, for the department to undertake repairs on its own and charge the owner. We have not had to do that in any circumstance that I'm aware of, but it is a tool that is at the state's disposal in the event that there was a threat to public safety.
So, not to prolong this too much, but what can you tell us in general about the state of public safety regarding the dams now?
What I can tell you is that we have approximately half a dozen current compliance orders, all for high hazard facilities, which means that they have a repair regime and schedule in place. That has come from the inspections. Those are the only high hazard facilities that we have determined there is a safety issue that needs to be addressed. It's six right now.
And of those, which are owned by the public versus private?
I believe they are all public.
And what are the six? Do you know?
Off the top of my head, I know that the Annapolis City had a facility that was on that list. We have Montgomery County has got a facility. Montgomery Auto Park has a dam that is in a compliance order. I don't have that list. I can
get
it.
That's okay. When you get a chance to BlackBerry and let us know, we'll read it out later.
And again, I don't have the backup. Among the second category, which is larger, significant hazard, possible loss of life, do you order them in quantitative, possible loss of one life versus possible loss of 1,000 lives?
We do. The high hazard dams are the ones that would result in loss of life.
Probable.
Even possible loss of life among the high hazards, meaning that there are people that live in the floodway downstream of the dam.
Well, in that case, the significant hazard is even less possible than the possible. I'm just reading what you gave us,
right,
and you ranked it, which seemed logical, probable, possible, and not really.
Significant hazard is classified as a significant loss of property, but we don't have, those are circumstances where we don't have residences that are proximate downstream of the floodway. And, you know, as part of the normal zoning process, we, you know, obviously there is a through identification of the floodplain, there's a normal process that takes place that generally prevents new development from taking place within a downstream floodway. That's how, in fact, the flood program works in general. So we have over time, I think, made more effort to ensure that there are fewer and fewer people living downstream of a dam that may fail.
You want to touch on Conowingo? I mean, no dam discussion is complete without touching on Conowingo.
What would you like to know about Conowingo?
Structural integrity, sediment issue, Army Corps.
There's obviously I guess for everybody else, the Conowingo facility is a power generating facility. Owned by Exelon on the Susquehanna River, and it is used for. It's a peak generating facility owned and operated by the power company. The structural integrity of that facility is both under the auspices of the department and of the federal government, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
And a failure Conowingo would be economic or environmental and economic disaster.
It'd be almost... too difficult to measure the impact of a failure of a large facility like that. There is a known...
Little Bay would be devastating.
That's correct.
But it also catches most of the sediment. Well, it doesn't catch it, but it, most of the sediment that flows into the bay comes down through there, right?
That's correct. And there's a known sediment issue with respect to Conowingo. It's well known that... there is a huge amount of sediment that is captured behind that dam. And at some point along the way, there's an ongoing discussion with the Corps of Engineers about trying to address the sediment buildup behind the dam. Sediment buildup occurs behind all dams. And in some cases, there's been a beneficial impact to that because they, in fact, entrain a lot of the sediment that is released from things like construction activity and agriculture activity, and they have some beneficial impact in terms of keeping the sediment out of the waterway. On the other hand, it's something that causes the sediment buildup happens continuously, and at some point you have loss of capacity. And the structure does not operate properly, so you have to address it through capital maintenance. Conowingo is such a large facility, though, that study is going to take many years for them to come up with a variety of different solutions for addressing the sediment.
It sounds like a dredging project, huh?
I'm probably too early to tell what it is that they're going to be ultimately looking at in terms of a solution to that problem.
Okay. All right. Well, I'd like to see as soon as you guys can get this online so people know, click on. I mean, it's an overlay of two things, right? It's an overlay of your risk strata, but it's also an overlay of the structural integrity age sort of thing. Not unlike when you look at bridges, it's not only the structural integrity of the bridge, it's the number of passengers that pass over it every day that then lifts out the picture of which ones should be our top priority in terms of funding, repair, and replacement.
Yeah, we have. The program has been managing this with GIS for some period of time. So the data is there. The data is online. The data is accessible and mappable internally. We have not generally historically provided it online. I think there were some concerns some years ago about the sensitivity of the data. But the fact of the matter is most people already know where these dams are to begin with. So.
Yeah, okay, we know already.
Right.
Okay. Well, great. Jay, thanks very, very much.
You might substitute the word good for safety in the name of your program, though.
Yeah. I appreciate that comment.
Do you look at, or does some other agency look at mitigation? If something were to happen, do you just look at the dam itself? For instance, right now on the Mississippi, they're just trying to get people out. I mean, there's certain places you don't build. It's just, it's the same thing as we were talking about the sea level rise.
Madam Treasurer, what I can tell you is that there is, and it's a shared responsibility with the Department of Natural Resources and us, with respect to an assessment of all of the dams, and you are probably aware that there has been a move among many in the natural resource community to eliminate dams because they're artificial structures and they impede the healthy movement of sediment through an ecosystem. So there is a more active discussion about trying to take dams out of service, in fact, to restore watersheds. And that is an assessment that looks at...
That's total discussion.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Jay. Okay, let's go to the Secretary's agenda.
Good morning, Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. We have 11 items on the Secretary's agenda this morning. There are 4 reports of emergency procurements. We would be happy to answer any of your questions.
Okay, any question on the Secretary's agenda? Comptroller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. The ayes have it. We move on now to the program Open Space.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, Meredith Lasbury for the Department of Natural Resources. We have 5 items on the agenda this morning. Be happy to answer any questions.
Program Open Space. What's the best item on your agenda?
Well, they're all terrific projects. But we do have one, a couple of folks here from Cambridge this morning.
Who's here from Cambridge? Come on down. Anybody here from Cambridge?
Odin Wheeler.
And Jackson Stanley, come on up.
Good morning.
Hi. Tell us about this one.
Governor, Cambridge is very excited about this project. It's a playground that we're looking to replace that's in a large community that does have a lot of children exposure. It has actually been recently made a bus stop there as well for the school children. It's a project that we're looking very much forward to completing, hopefully, if this is approved, and working with DNR and Chip Price and his department and Margaret Lasher, and trying to hope to get this done maybe by the 1st of August, so the children will still have time to use it.
What's the neighborhood?
It's the Meadow Avenue Playground. It's in the area of, I know you're familiar with Cambridge, of Race Street, Academy Street, Cedar Street. It basically is encompassed by 2 of our main thoroughfares, Cedar Street and Washington Street.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in a very dense populated area that will serve a large number of our children and the citizens of Cambridge.
Great. Okay, any questions? Controller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it. We move on now to the Department of Budget Management.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Say hey to the mayor for us.
Thank you. I'm well.
Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, good morning. There are 6 items on the Department of Budget and Management's agenda for today, and we'll be happy to answer your questions.
Mr. Comptroller?
Madam Secretary, item 3, as I noticed that's DJS retroactive approval of 6 contracts.
Item 3 is a request for retroactive approval of 6 contracts so that they can obtain licensed contractors who will provide residential and non-residential services for DGS youth who are getting ready to go before the juvenile courts. The new Secretary of DBED is here.
Thank you, Madam Secretary.
Thank you.
Governor?
Is this your first time here?
Yes, it is.
Identify yourself for the record, if you would.
My name is Sam Abbott. I'm the Secretary of Juvenile Services for the state of Maryland.
Thank you.
I actually wanted to ask Secretary Abbott to come up and say that I've never been so happy to see six retroactive contracts because I believe at our June meeting you're prepared to bring some prospective contracts for our review and approval. And if you are and that actually happens, I congratulate you because we've approved a lot of retroactive contracts out of your agency, and if you can get that straightened out so that we're following the normal process, my hat's off to you.
Absolutely, Mr. Comptroller. That is exactly what's going to happen. We have prospective contracts coming. We did identify these as soon as I was appointed by Governor O'Malley. I launched an investigation to determine whether this issue had been fully resolved. We did identify some areas of weakness which have been addressed now, and henceforth we should have prospective contracts for all of the services that the department utilizes.
Oh, I applaud you and the governor, and the treasurer obviously has noted this, that these are extraordinarily important services, but they're also expensive. And we're talking almost $180 million with these six contracts we're approving today that we've approved retroactively. And I'm very pleased to hear that it will be different in the future.
I appreciate that, and I appreciate the opportunity to come before the board, and last week coming before the staff as well to go over the details of this, and I'm certainly prepared to do that. I think that has been communicated. I do also want to take the opportunity to introduce some new members of the team. Deputy Secretary Holmes will be the Deputy Secretary for our support services, which will cover this area. And, of course, Tammy Brown is retained as our chief of staff. Michael DiBattista is our budget manager. And what you see there is the universe of people who would be presenting to the Board of Public Works moving forward.
Governor Comptroller, I did take the opportunity, since, you know, I'm elected the current to attend the staff meeting last week. And I must say I was very impressed by the secretary, his presentation, and the staff that he had with them, and who seemed to be really on top of the issues. As the comptroller pointed out, you know, I've been watching this now county legislative service for a long time. And it's a very important service. There are few things more important, in fact, to the state and the community than a good productive and successful juvenile services program, but it's very hard to do. And I am very impressed by your new staff, the reorganization, and the fact that you seem to have the lines of reporting and control a little more rationalized. The proof of the pudding, my mother would say, is in the eating, and we'll see, but I think it really is. I think everyone who was at the meeting agreed that it really is very promising, and the fact that you're really trying to clear out the problems and go forward now. You have our support, we'll be watching.
Absolutely. I appreciate the support, and I will be watching as well, because while I will hold my staff accountable, I hold myself accountable to those same standards. We have laws and we have rules, and they must be followed, and this department will be following all of the rules, whether it be procurement or otherwise. They are there for a reason. Before I came to this position and previous to my work in Virginia, I was a prosecutor. I'm an attorney. I am cognizant of the rule of law. It's very important to me to follow the rules, and we will be doing just that.
Excellent. Okay. Secretary, thank you. Performance in DJS has been a real sore point for this board for 4 years. I'm glad you're making changes. know that you have authority to make whatever changes you need to in personnel to improve it. Anybody, anything else on this matter? Or any other matters?
We have one speaker who requested to speak on six items, and three of them are on this agenda. I don't know if the board wants to entertain the request.
On the DDM agenda?
Well, three of them.
Is this Ms. Jalabat?
This is Ms.
Jalabat, why don't you give us rapid fire? I know you have a number of items that you wanted to talk about.
Mr. Jalabat asked yesterday if he could speak on DBM items 1, 2, and 3, and also some university items.
Hey, good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Controller. I will attempt to be very brief because I've already sent you a brief in terms of outlining my issues. And with respect to the item with respect to the DGS item with respect to the nonprofit contracts that are asked to be approved this morning through the preference program, I want to make it very clear that I am not here this morning to speak against the preference program. I think that program certainly has merit, and it has proven to provide a benefit to the state of Maryland. I would ask this board, however, there seems to be a really serious problem with regard to how we treat the issue of minority participation on the preference program, all of them, not this, just this project. And I decided to come here this morning.
What project are we on again? I'm sorry, Mr.
Well, we're talking about the one with the
DGS item 3, the retroactive
The retro there.
The Secretary was just speaking of.
Okay.
There are several contracts in here where all of them, of course, are awarded to nonprofits. And under the state's MBE stature, several nonprofits are defined as minority participation, minority business enterprise. That's a legislative decision that, unfortunately, I don't agree with, but I think that what I'm here this morning to ask this board, that when we award contracts through the preference program to nonprofits who are classified and defined as minority, the law, the state's minority business statute, does not allow nonprofits to serve as their own minority business enterprise for purposes of meeting minority business enterprise contract goals. And I think there is a considerable amount of dollars now going and being awarded to the preference program. And as I said before, I'm not against that, but I believe that under the current structure of the MBE statute, we ought to apply and require the nonprofits who awarded these preference contracts. We should require them to follow the law with respect to meeting MBE utilization goals. That's all I'm here this morning to ask this board. Because under the current system, the nonprofits can serve as their own MBE. And I would submit to you that is counter to the intent and purpose of the MBE statute. There are a number of non-nonprofits who can do some of the work that these nonprofits are being awarded. And all I'm saying, if the current law is going to say that nonprofits cannot meet their own MBE goals, then a clear reading of the law should say that we should follow that law until we get a change. There may be a time when we want to get a change, but under the current law, it is not permissible for a nonprofit to meet its own MBE goal. And I would respectfully ask this board to give support to the law and allow or require the nonprofits who are being awarded these preference contracts to also meet the goal just like all other contractors. I think that is a fair and reasonable request. And again, I would respectfully ask this board to make sure that the agencies who are sending to you these nonprofit contracts in millions of dollars, the Business Journal did a study several months ago, which showed that under the state's minority program, the nonprofits are the leading recipients of the MBE dollars. And I don't think that we never intended it to be that way, but it's just working out well, the nonprofits. And again, I'm not necessarily per se against the number, but I want the playing field, Mr. Controller, to be fair and equitable, where all of the minority entities can have a fair opportunity. And I don't think that's an unreasonable request, Governor. So with that, I don't think that I need to explain my position any further. I don't know if the Secretary wants me to elaborate on other contracts. I have two other concerns with the University of Maryland systems. I'm not sure that I'm permitted to speak on that at this point, but if assuming that the board...
Let's do this, Mr. Jolliver. You have a number of items that you want to speak on. So are there any others that are on this Department of Budget Management portion of the agenda? I'll bring you back up when we get to the other agenda.
Thank you.
Sure. Let me ask, Mary, did you have a point of order that you thought Mary Jo might be
answering? It was pointed out to me that there is a task force that has been set up to look at the question of the nonprofit contracting that Mary Jo is heading, I guess.
Thank you, Treasurer.
The board's procurement officer.
Thank you, Treasurer. Yes, the General Assembly has formed a task force to study the procurement of educational and social services, and the Treasurer is actually a member of that task force, and our kickoff meeting is tomorrow afternoon, and one of the issues that will be front and center is the issue of MBE involvement on human services contracts. So I think many of Mr. Jolivet's concerns will be discussed at length by some folks who are very experienced and very well-versed on these issues. So perhaps the task force will come up with some innovative ideas on maximizing MBE participation in human services procurements.
I'm glad it was brought home to me that I was on the task force. But that's going forward?
Yes, ma'am.
Could I ask the Secretary of Minority? I mean, this question of the specific question that was raised of the nonprofit constituting its own sub.
For the record, LaWanda Jenkins, Governor's Office of Minority Affairs. Mr. Jolivet raised a multitude of issues surrounding this one agenda item to the issue of nonprofits. The state's MBE law currently does allow for certain nonprofits whose missions focus on the needs of the developmentally disabled to qualify for minority status in the program. Our health and human service agencies do tend to contract in large proportion with nonprofit providers. That was what Mr. Jolivet was referencing in terms of the BBJ article. That is not the predominant level of participation for the statewide MBE program. Nonprofits are largely in our health and human service agencies. The issue specific to the item dealing with the Department of Juvenile Services, what we have done with provider contracts, in order to begin to get some level of minority participation, we are holding the contractors or providers who have 25 beds or slots. We are now challenging them to meet some level of minority participation. We have worked with the agencies to put a 5% goal on the larger provider contracts. So when a nonprofit provider is awarded one of these contracts, that provider is subcontracting out or outsourcing 5% of the contract. What Mr. Jolivet is contending is that that nonprofit cannot self-perform the contract, and I will tell you they are not. They are outsourcing a portion of that contract to other certified MBEs. And the supporting documentation that my office reviewed for the Board of Public Works pre-bid meetings have included those nonprofit firms and their MBE subcontractors to meet the requirement on these contracts.
And that's for, not for beds, but for other services that are
proposed? It can either be for beds or slots, for other per child or per person care. But it's the larger providers that we are asking to meet a 5% MBE goal. And what Mr. Jolivet is saying is that that provider should not be or should be made to outsource that goal, and I'm saying that they
That's
are.
What's happening.
Yes, that is what is happening. He is contending that one of the providers is performing the goal with their own workforce, and that's not the case. It happens to be an MBE provider that he is questioning on this particular agenda item.
So you would agree with Mr. Jolivet's concern that to the extent that there is a goal, it is a subcontracting goal.
Another entity should be brought in, and they are being brought in. Mr. Jolivet's concern came to us at 5 p.m. yesterday, and we have looked
That's
into
Mr.
it.
That's Mr. Jolivet's special.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I have been known to do that, but I apologize. If it requires a state employee to stay maybe a few hours late, perhaps that's not a good idea. But nonetheless, I think that I submitted in all due respect, in good faith. But my concern is that when I read the Board of Public Works agenda and it says that I have to believe that I can rely on what the information that is stated in the board's agenda, and it says quite categorically that the provider is meeting 100% of the MBE goal, and I don't know anything other than to what to rely on. So Ms. Jenkins is probably right, and I have no reason to dispute her, but I want to see if maybe in the future that we can state on the board's official public records what is being done. That's all I'm asking.
The 100% relates to Mosaic, which is a MBE provider. So that is why it reads 100%. But they are subcontracting a portion of their participation. There is supporting documentation that you as board members receive to that effect.
But it's not on the agenda.
It's not on the actual agenda item. It's part of your backup.
If I could just add, I think, you know, what may be confusing is that our agenda does say MBE participation. It has 100%, but it's 100% because the prime contractor is an MBE.
Right, as I understand, but our question is why wouldn't it
say that
on the agenda?
Well, and the ones where they're 5%?
Well, in terms of clarification, that is something that we can add.
Okay, good.
So I'm interested in two things. So these, from now on, we can clarify that these projects meet the law.
They do.
And in the future, you're going to be looking on this task force.
There's somebody tapping you on your shoulder trying to tell you why we can't do that.
No, what she's telling me, if you look at 9B, we have listed those on
exactly.
The item.
Yeah.
So we do that.
The of the agenda.
If we look at what, 9B?
On the
whose agenda?
Page 9B of the DBM agenda.
Oh. I'm going to figure out how these places are numbered.
Okay, top right-hand corner, 9B.
Yep.
Okay, so it shows MBE participation. We show the 100% as well as we show the 5% subcontracting goal.
I'm not seeing that.
No. It says one of the providers is a certified MBE, and that means that they'll be 100%. But then it says that three providers have a 0% goal and three providers have a 5% goal. And since there are only six providers and three are six, I think what it's saying is that one of them is 100%, but each of those six actually has a subcontract goal on a 5%.
What does it say there?
MBE participation.
This is item 3S.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I see it.
Page 9.
Okay. I'm reading one of the six providers is an MDOT certified MBE.
And I think there should have been a period there, and that was the end of that complete thought, telling you that one of the six is.
That's the 100%.
And that's Mosaic?
Right.
Okay.
Mosaic, correct.
So there should have been a period right there. That's the end of that thought. And then the next thought is that of the six contracts, there's six total. Three of them have a 0% goal, and three of them have a 5% goal. And obviously then one of the six, that's Mosaic, comes in that second thought of the 0% or the 5% goal. And it tells you to turn to that page 12 to see which of the six has zero and which of them has five.
So three of the providers are small-scale providers. They are not subject to a goal.
The
three larger providers have a 5% goal.
I need a codebreaker to figure that one out.
But the important thing is these meet the requirement.
They absolutely do.
Here, and you're looking at how to improve it.
All right, we'll score one for Mr. Jalabet to make this clear.
Good point.
Any Comptroller moves approval?
But also, if I could just suggest that, Mr. Jalabet, we appreciate your attending this, but maybe we could get a phone number so that these things could be checked out beforehand, because it's obviously an effort for you to prepare your presentation and come down and appear before us, and just to make sure that the facts are, you know what I'm saying. It could save everybody a lot of time, because I appreciate the need for more clarification here, but we want to make sure you're protesting things that are, in fact, problems. And if you can clear up some of this stuff beforehand, I'll give you my phone number. Well, you have my phone number, but that's what I'm saying.
I agree with you, and obviously I've got way more things to do than appear before this board to make arguments against contracts. But what I say here, I still think that I'm right with regard to the 100% contracting, because I've seen it before. And the only reason that I came here today, because I've seen the same identical structure and wording before, and contrary to Ms. Jenkins' assertions, it didn't work out that way. So, not to beat a dead horse, but I think I've made my point.
Okay.
Anything else? Controller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed, nay. The ayes have it. We move on now to the University System of Maryland.
Good morning. Joe Evans, representing the University System of Maryland. We have 9 items on the agenda today. Here to answer any questions.
Questions, University System of Maryland.
And Mr. Jalabet.
Anyone? Mr. Jalabet, you want to comment on the University System of Maryland? You had something on this one as well, right?
Yes, I did. And again, I think my letter to you was rather self-explanatory. And to make a long story short, what I'm asserting to you is that the state's MBE regulations found in Comar sets out a dual advertising strategy to make sure that the agency not only advertises a certain contract in the regular traditional way on their website, in the other prescribed way, but they also must send a very specific copy of the procurement solicitation and notice of the solicitation, as I outlined in my letter, directly to MBEs. They also, under the COMAR, are required to send a copy of the solicitation along with a copy of the bid proposal to the Governor's Office of Minority Affairs, who in turn transmits those solicitations and the RFP documents to the local minority trade associations and the minority contracting group. Now, this assures, at least attempts to assure, that the minority contracting and business community will have a fair and equal opportunity to learn of the proposal. I think you would agree with me that if the contracting community doesn't know of the procurement, there's no chance that they would bid on it. So what I'm submitting to this board this morning, this is a case where the agency, in all due respect, did not comply with all of the different procedures in advertising the contract, particularly the procedure that requires direct advertising to the minority business community. And I'm asking this board, because we see this so often, I'm asking this board, if we are really serious about involving our minority contracting community, let us not approve these contracts when it comes to the board where there's evidence clear convincing evidence that the agency did not comply with the procurement solicitation, I would think that this board would be within this authority to not approve the contract. And that's all I'm asking this board this morning. That's all, Governor.
Thanks, Mr. Jolivet. How about a response from University of Maryland Systems? This is Coppin.
Coppin, item 7, I believe. He's
Coppin State University.
Management services for the residence halls at Coppin.
Mr. Evans, what about that assertion?
I don't agree, disagree with Mr. Jolivet. He's absolutely correct. In this case, it was an oversight on Coppin's plate, point to directly solicit the MBEs and to send the notice to the Governor Office of Minority Affairs. However, what I submit is though by advertising, that solicitation went out to 84 contractors, of which 23 of them were MBEs. So the intent, as I read Comar at 10:30 last night while I was working on this, was so that there would be sufficient number of MBEs that could respond or would respond to a solicitation. And although they didn't do it correctly, the end result was it did get out to 23 MBEs that had the opportunity to submit a proposal in. Of those, we received no MBEs, none submitted.
So what's the percentage that they're getting?
They're doing 10%. But I think what Mr. Jolivet is asserting is that it was put in place, so I guess to get prime MBEs. But this particular procurement has a 10% MBE goal on it.
What are they building here?
This is for the management of the resident hall.
This is a service contract. It actually is not the same type of scope that Mr. Jolivet is speaking of with the construction management. This is the same issue, but it's a service contract to run the residence hall's housing services.
So at Coppin. So this isn't a building, this isn't a construction thing?
No, that's why I'm not sure that some of the regulations have it. But I think there is still, I mean, he's still supposed to send notices to GOMA
sure.
that there's an opportunity, but it's not the same.
Ms. Jenkins, do you want to respond?
I would love to respond. As Mr. Evans indicated, all state agencies use eMaryland Marketplace as the online website portal. It is the efficient way for all vendors, including minority firms, to find out about bid solicitations. Yes, as an added value solicitation distribution, agencies will send GOMA solicitations. We, in turn, send them out to the trade associations, who, in turn, publish them on their websites. To my knowledge, the Maryland Minority Contractors and the Maryland DC, Mr. Frazier's organization, and the Supplier Development Council all have very robust websites, and they regularly post our notices on their websites. I'm not aware that Mr. Jolivet's firm has such a mechanism to get distribution of notices out. I've never seen them, but we do regularly supply trade associations with notices. On the matter of Coppin, as Mr. Evans mentioned, we did pull the eMaryland Marketplace solicitation report, and in fact, we do have a list of the 84 firms and 23 MBE firms who directly received the solicitation. They received so because vendors register on eMaryland Marketplace to receive solicitations by certain categories of work. And again, it is the most efficient way for firms who want to do business with the state to receive solicitations specific to what they are in business to do. And it is a very efficient system for doing so. I will certainly give this to Ms. McDonald if you'd like to share
this
with members.
Did they meet GOMA or not? Did they do what they were required to do or not?
I think that Coppin did satisfy the requirement for solicitation on this one, yes.
On the service or on the...
On the service. On the solicitation for the contract to manage the resident halls.
Governor, let me just close with this, not a rebuttal, but the very purpose of the Comar requirement, the two-stage requirement, assuming that they did send it out directly, and I have no evidence to contradict that, but the other stage of sending it to the Office of Minority Affairs is also a very integral requirement that was not met. And many times, in spite and notwithstanding the fact that it was sent out directly to minority firms, a good number of minority firms ultimately receive their solicitation notice by virtue that someone from the Governor's Office of Minority Affairs sent it to me or someone else in the trade association, and we in turn send it directly to some of our constituents. Now, I know that we live in an internet age, but the fact of the matter, Governor, a lot of small minority firms don't have internet. And you said, well, how can they be competitive in the world of business without having access to the internet? Well, the fact of the matter, there are a number of them that just don't. And there's 5 or 6, 10% of them that don't have access to the internet or don't market themselves through the internet. And the only way that they get notice, or the most direct way that they get notice, is when the Governor's Office of Minority Affairs sends the notice to us, and we in turn distribute it throughout our constituency. But I think that this was a serious violation, and I would ask this board, and I remind the board, about 2 months ago, where we had this exact identical situation where the agency did not send it to the Governor's Office of Minority Affairs, and it did not send it directly to minority firms, and the agency itself agreed that it was a violation, and they withdrew the contract and put it out for additional bids. And that was the Maryland Stadium Authority. You are keenly aware of this particular contract, and it was at Coffin State. It was a demolition contract. So I would remind this board that there is precedent, ample precedent, where the agency, for whatever reason, neglects to send the contract notice out, according to Comar, to the Governor's Office of Minority Affairs, that is appropriate to reject the bid and put it out for additional bidding.
Somebody wants to say something?
I just want to say for the record that there's two different agencies here. You had that agency was the Stadium Authority. We're talking about Coppin. This was just an oversight on Coppin's part. And again, I think the intent of Comar, which was to get sufficient MBE participation or notice, that was met, although they didn't follow Comar to the letter.
Okay. Anybody else?
Did you want to say something?
No, I am reading the regulations, and I am clarifying that for all services and construction that there is a requirement that they send the notice to GOMA. I had thought perhaps there was something different for the university on services, but...
And Ms. Jenkins, was it your assertion that they did send the notice to you, but they did it electronically?
I'm not sure whether or not Coppin sent us the notice on this particular solicitation. We went online to verify that they did send it out through email and mail marketplace, which is what they did.
But that's a different issue.
And they solicited 23MBEs through email and marketplace.
But Ms. Jenkins, may I remind you, that is a totally different supposition. Totally different. There are two... Well, I don't want to go back. I don't want to.
You said it. I mean, Mr. Evans said that
Mr. Evans agreed.
There's
no
issue.
Correct? There's no difference. There is an issue.
Right. Well, what I was saying to the board, though, there's a.
Mr. Chalabet, can you give us 2 seconds?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't mean to interrupt you.
Give you 2 seconds.
What do we want to do here?
Would you like it withdrawn for 2 weeks that we can prepare response?
What happens if. Mr. Chairman, what happens if we reject this?
I guess the problem is that if it's rejected, the pricing for these two companies, which is a niche, the one requirements of the RFP was that the vendors had to have experience in managing university and university resident halls. And
there's
so,
no way these are small companies without computers.
Yeah. But we can make that argument. But
no, that's the reality. There's no way you can have a small company without internet access doing this contract.
But my point is, how do we know? We didn't do our due diligence, so consequently there could be other minority firms who are capable and who have the experience, but they didn't get the required notice. And what I'm saying, the only reason I'm here today, because I'm representing a firm who called me and says, I didn't know about this, and we didn't get notice on it. And I guess I will submit.
Did they email you, or did they?
They didn't email me, though.
Two other people come up and want to speak on this item now that they see it possibly going south.
Hi. I'm Thomas Dawson, Director of Procurement at Cobb, and I was the one who handled the RFP. Let me state that the management team that put together the specifications tailored it so that it was to be a management contract only. There was no other type of services that were involved in that solicitation. So the thought was there probably could be no MBE participation on this contract because we went out and looked at several companies and talked to other universities that had outsourced this type of contract. And we found that, first of all, there were no companies in Maryland that actually did this type of work and that there were no MBEs that were actually qualified to do this. The reason why we did, in turn, put a 10% goal on this contract was because we insisted that there be some type of ancillary services involved in this contract that MBEs could participate in. That was done at the very last minute before this contract was advertised, and that's the reason why we overlooked sending that to GOMA for their approval.
I thought you said you sent it to...
No, we did not. We did not. We did post this on email and marketplace, and we found that there were 84 vendors that this solicitation was sent to, and of those 84, 23 were MBE businesses, which is about 27%. None of those businesses responded to an RFP, nor did they attend our pre-bid conference. So we submit that we did do proper due diligence and trying to outreach to MBE companies. However, we found that there were none, including other businesses, that were actually qualified to do the type of services that we were looking for.
Could you explain the 10% that you did get of minority participation on this contract?
Yes, 10%. I cannot recall what the business is, but it is a company that will be doing facility management of that portion of that contract that was not originally included in the original scope of the contract.
But you did that as a value-added effort to
Absolutely.
Achieve some level of minority participation on the contract.
That is correct, yes.
What I'm hearing is that the university says that it did not send a notice to the Governor's Office of Minority Affairs, and that is the only thing it failed to do. And technically, it is required under the regulations to send that notice. There is a very good probability that if the board wanted to, you are permitted to permit the award of a contract that could be voidable where a technical regulation was violated. If the board were to find that the parties acted in good faith, if you were to find that the procurement contract ratifying it would not undermine the purposes of this law, and that the violation or serious violations was insignificant. If you make those findings, you certainly can approve the contract with a technical violation. I believe if some of the people from Coffin might describe how these residence halls are being managed right now by one employee on staff,
the
serious problem that you have and what it means for the university's enrollment and all that, you might tell them how important the contract is.
Yes. Good morning. I'm Sprinter Bass, Executive Director of Capital Planning and University Budgets. Our university goals, as you know, is graduation and retention and also enrollment. We have a management problem in the residence halls. It was being managed by one person.
One person.
Although we inadvertently, it was an oversight not to send the solicitation to the Governor's Office of Minority Affairs, we did make a valiant effort to do MBE participation. We are very proactive as a historical black university. And the impact, Governor, that you asked, if it was not, this item was not approved, would gravely impact the university, as the university residence halls will be opening up in August. And we need to put the contract in place to get them started, to be prepared for the fall semester at Coffin.
So your failure to mail it was not willful?
No, sir.
And you felt you were making the attempt of posting it electronically? Including sending it to 84 contractors, 23 of whom were certified MBEs?
That's correct.
Okay. Anybody else?
I just come back to my point, Mr. Jolivet, if you can come down a week in advance so that we don't have these traffic jams here, I would be appreciative and meet with the staff and communicate these concerns. I think on this one you have a valid concern, but because of the effective date of the contract and because of Coppin's situation, I'm just not sure we can meet your a request. And then, of course, we have the letters coming the evening before, so we can't really satisfactorily resolve some of these things from your perspective. And I assume that my board colleagues are going to approve the contract, and I'll support them in that, but also repeat my request. I'll give you Klassmeyer's phone number. Call him. just so we can together do the right thing. That's what I'm asking down the road. Sorry about that.
No problem. Right.
Maybe the board secretary could send out a reminder to the agencies of this process. It's not just the Office of Minority Affairs, but also the Office of Business Advocacy and Small Business.
You have effective.
Or for the permits updated.
I have it thanks to Mr. Delavette, actually, who cited that. That's correct.
Okay.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to just be here and to have the board to hear my view. And, Mr. Petrola, I appreciate your suggestion, and I assure the board that I will do my best, my very best, to make sure that any item that I send the board a request, that it will, I will check with the staff or the agency to make sure that my concern is real and bona fide.
And often they are.
Yeah. So I think more his point. In other words, if we'd known ahead, we could postpone some of these items and you'd have an opportunity to meet and bring your client. What have you. But anyway. Okay, Treasurer moves approval, seconded by the controller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed, nay. The ayes have it. We now move on to the Department of Information Technology.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. L.H. Slinger, Department of Information Technology. This morning we have two items on the agenda. I would be glad to answer any questions at this time.
Questions?
If I could, Governor, I just wanted to thank the Secretary for item two. I think that's in your portfolio.
Correct.
It's a master contract award for six firms.
For telecommunications audits.
Right.
Would you like a little bit of history on that or background on that?
Briefly.
Sure. We have had some very successful history in the past in hiring third parties to audit telephone or telecom billings. In the past, it has generally been a single contract award. So going out this time, we decided to open it up and create an opportunity for more than one. Actually, there are six offerors who are going to compete for tasks. And when, in fact, we have an opportunity for someone to come in and audit, it will go to propose to the state. We will judge, if you will, on their technical approach, as well as the most favorable commission that they will charge the state for that work.
Excellent. Well, and you estimate that we may recover $1 million?
I believe we
may have to pay them $1 million in commissions.
Well, let me just back up and say that these firms will not charge the state at all until, in fact, there is a recovery. So to the state, there is no risk. There's no upfront cost. I will also say that history will tell you that some of the recoveries have been quite significant, and it's beneficial to the state.
So how much would they have to recover to get $1 million in commissions?
Well, we asked them to provide the maximum commission rates. And of the six, they were in the range of 24%, I believe, in that area to 35%. And that rate, of course, would go to depend on the nature of the work that they do. But again, by opening this up to six firms, based on what they're going to bid, that would drive their rate to be the most, I mean, competitive. So
I think it's terrific, right? And I hope that we see more of these, because I think it's smart fiscal management to, in effect, do a commission search for what I take are overbillings. These companies are not obviously in business of making refunds to us unless there's proof that we've been overcharged.
That's true. And just to be fair in part to telecommunications companies and the state, these telephone bills or telecom bills are very complex, and it does take an expert, unfortunately, sometimes after the fact, to sort through it and figure out who owes who what.
So you think it's the complexity and not deliberate overbilling?
I think it's a large part the complexity as well as, say, the volume. I mean, the state receives literally thousands of bills every year, and it does take a significant effort and expertise to look at all those bills and make the determination as to whether, in fact, there has been overbilling.
And, Madam Secretary, if there are other agencies or accounts that might be subject to this kind of model where vendor overpayment by us is can be identified and recaptured without, you know, on a percentage basis, I take it. There may be other instances of this you already got, but if you could maybe keep us informed about how this particular audit does and if there are other instances where this is applicable.
And that is part of our cost containment and balancing strategy. And actually, we've had discussions with Elliot, and even in terms of going forth in this year's budget, we assume from recoveries that we would be able to get X amount of dollars. So we've been working with the agencies to
see other instances like this in the foreseeable future. I really am attracted to this model for recoveries, I guess, or efficiencies.
And so are we.
Maybe I could give you my phone bill, too. Because life of me, I can't figure the thing out. So, Secretary Schlanger, thank you for bringing this before us. I think it's probably something that we should explore doing in other audits in your agency, but other agencies that may have analogous opportunities for recovery. It's good. Good job.
Thanks. Please, we agree, and we look forward to good results.
Governor, sure. Talking about recovery, I have a question about the second one, the CCU, the Central Collections Unit. I understand this is an extension, I guess, because we have bought into this hardware and software.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it's item one. I think you said two.
It's item one. Sorry.
So, actually, Anthony Fugit, who's head of the Central Collections Unit, is here. But essentially, this is just a contract to provide software maintenance and support services.
Right.
We are in the process of procuring.
That was my question.
Right. A new system, and we're still working on that. That's underway.
Okay. So we are going to compete a new system at some point,
yes.
Not simply be
yes.
Caught.
Correct.
Thank you.
Controller moves enthusiastically for approval. Seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye.
Thank you.
All opposed? The ayes have it.
Thank you.
Now we move on to the Department of Transportation.
Good morning, Madam Treasurer. Governor, Mr. Comptroller.
For the record, Daryl Mobley, representing MDOT. MDOT is presenting 17 items today, as item 18L mod has previously been withdrawn. For the record, item 6M has previously been revised.
Any questions?
I have a question there. It's not just on this, but the automated fare collection, that's 12.
Item 12, automated fare collection, smart cards, et cetera.
Well, my basic question, and the answer maybe is just WMATA. It's not us at all. But this company that we go with, Qubit, you know what I mean?
Qubit Transportation.
Yeah. What is this problem they're having with, I mean, we keep re-upping this company, and it's a brand-new automated company, but my neighbors who use WMATA, use Metro, are having real problems with their cards, and it is ascribed to this company's software. Do you know... They can't refill their cards because the cards say, well, they're due in 2036, and they can't do anything until 2036. I mean, a spate of these people who happen to live in Silver Spring or Bethesda, apparently, who ride the red line.
Yeah, good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, Jim Knighton, I'm Director of Procurement at Maryland Transit Administration and appearing before you for the first time. I wish I had the answer to that question. I don't know. I do know that other transit systems around the country have had issues with Qubit, and they happen to be a dominant player out there. And we've worked with them for many years, working through various issues with them, and we hope with this extension that we're finally at the end of that process. But I can't speak to the specific issue relating to the WMATA cards.
Okay. It might have been the bus. I mean, my assumption was it was Red Line because that's what they said. But it was WMATA.
Right.
Yes, it's the subway.
And it was Qubit. Well, if you could just let us know what's happening with that, it would be very helpful.
Absolutely.
I could put it on my home answering machine. While you're negotiating with people. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions, Department of Transportation?
Item one.
Item one. Item one is change order number one to provide funding for two additional mobile speed enforcement vehicles. Representing the department, we do have staff here to address any questions from State Highway Bob Yang and Eric Tavich.
Maybe not. Good morning, Governor, Board Members, Bob Gates, State Highway Administration.
Bob, what do you do to yourself at work, son?
Actually, it's, Governor, it was too many years of thinking I was an athlete, and now, 10 years after I stopped playing everything, it is called up to me. I have to have ankle fusion, so it's a slow process. I'll be kind of appearing before you like this for the next couple of months.
Wow, when did that happen?
I had the operation March the 30th.
Wow.
Yeah, so it'll be a while.
So. That's good for building up your army.
There you go.
So I obviously support this program, but I'm interested in, do you set these up in work zones where there aren't people working?
Like I said, I had Eric Tabachek, he's a program director. I need to speak to that.
Eric Tabachek, State Highway Administration. Yes, we do. We do that because national studies have shown that 80% of the injuries and fatalities that have happened in work zones happen to motorists themselves. So this is a 24-hour program.
And has it reduced the accidents and fatalities?
Yes, ma'am.
Fatalities.
We have found, our studies have shown that we have reduced accidents probably by 10% since the program has begun.
Including in places that are not actually work zones?
No, just within the work zones.
Where there are not actually people working?
Correct.
A lot of that, if I could speak, is a lot of that is due to lane restrictions, too. The lane restriction could be there. It's 24 hours a day. You could go from a 12-foot lane to a 10-foot lane restriction, and it's there all the time. So you want
we ensure that the locations that we place, where we have the deployments, there's some type of change in the roadway configuration where it could be shoulders have been reduced, the lane widths or splits in lanes or something like that. So it's 24 hours.
And just to follow the line, the shoulders were reduced or the lanes changed for a road construction reason.
Correct.
Not.
No, ma'am.
I'm concerned because we first heard about this, obviously, after some serious accidents involving, in fact, the MDOT workers.
Yes.
And it made a lot of sense because I know as a driver, people do speed through. And there is. We had not heard this other rationale that I recall. Not to argue with it, but that the problem is the injury to the drivers, not the workers. We had not heard.
I just wanted to bring it up. I support the program, but I hope that there's some monitoring of this because it has lots of little offspring. I mean, you drive through Chevy Chase, Maryland, and you're all of a sudden getting flooded with $40 tickets for, I'm sure that they're technically correct, but at some point, the question is, are we actually doing what worker protection and driver protection we're talking about, as opposed to generating a lot of revenue, which we need, but there might be a better way to generate revenue than these systems. And I say that very delicately because I don't want to get involved in the people that don't like these at all. But just looking at the 432,000 citations that you're given and the considerable amounts of revenue that are generated, I just want to make sure someone on top is monitoring this to restrict it to what it's supposed to be doing.
And I supplied a list of possible locations. And most of the locations are on the Capitol Beltway for the upcoming projects. The past projects have been on, of course, I-95, I-695 at Charles Street, I-695 at Liberty Road, on Maryland 290, or on I-295 at the Beltway also. So the ones we're putting out are the mobile speed cameras. They're not the mounted ones that are in school zones, and they are in basically in work zones on interstate highways. I think about I-70 also as another location.
The State Highway Administration's program is freeways only, work zones. The programs that are in question right now are the school, some of the school zone residential ones that are run by local communities. We are attempting to work with them to holding the reins on them to ensure that they're following all the laws and regulations, but they're basically local programs.
Just make sure it's,
yes, sir.
Someone is looking at it, because at some point you can lose perspective.
Yes, sir.
More popular support. I had always thought that the people being hit by the people, as the treasurer indicated, and the comptroller's line of questioning, I had always assumed that the people that were injured were the workers. But say what you said again, that the majority of the injuries that occur in work zones are actually the motorists themselves because of the lane restrictions, the shoulders, the narrowing of lanes, and the like.
That's correct, sir.
Hmm. Interesting.
It makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't part of the original narrative.
Yeah.
As I heard it, but I wasn't at the hearing. I just signed these things once they sent it. Okay. Any other questions on MDOT?
Move approval.
Treasurer seconds. All in favor, signify by saying aye. All opposed, nay. The ayes have it. And that concludes our agenda.
No.
Oh, sorry. I saw the pack-up language from I saw the pack-up motion from the comptroller. Like Pavlov's dog.
Hang on.
When I saw that big
Gary Klausmeier binder closed. DGS.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. The Department of General Services has 14 items, and we have revised item 6. Glad to answer any questions you might have on these items.
Controller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, saying aye. Aye, and the ayes have it. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Comptroller. Uh-huh.
You haven't figured out why?
I haven't figured out why.